Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we have a very special show for you today. It's going to be another quick introduction. You know, sometimes I feel like just shouting out, how you doing? We ought to do this in front of a live audience every now and then. That'd be kind of cool. At the back end of the show, we're going to be doing part three of the series I'm doing called Getting Down to Basics with the People of Sanford. It's about the Basics Bus Tour in Sanford, Florida. Before that, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about developments in Egypt. And opening the show up is a segment I'm really, really excited to be doing. I think it's an extremely important segment, and it's following up on a segment we did a couple weeks ago where we heard from Dr. Christian Head about the racism he encountered as a black surgeon at UCLA Medical School. And this week we're going to continue that conversation on the impact of racism on medical care in the U.S. with John Hoberman. John is the author of Black and Blue, The Origins and Consequences of Medical Racism, and he teaches at the University of Texas in Austin. John, welcome to the show. Tell me this, man. I went through your book and I was thinking about all this. You know, we talked after about a week after I had had Dr. Head on my show, and we talked about how Dr. Head, what's going on with him at the UCLA Medical School is not an isolated phenomenon. And I was thinking about this, you know, and it occurs within an overall societal context, but also within a deeply embedded and long-lived racism permeating the field of medicine. You know, you've done a tremendous study around this. And how deep does this go in the medical world?
I'm afraid it's pervasive. I mean, what happened to Dr. Head, that kind of abuse in front of an audience that offered almost no protest at a residence event in 2006. It took years for him to file this lawsuit. He was traumatized, et cetera. I mean, if this can happen at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, which is an elite institution, the question is which medical faculties in this country can guarantee a racially decent professional environment for doctors of color. Several years ago, the president of the American Medical Association offered an apology to America's black doctors, you know, from a historical perspective, from all of the abuse and discrimination that they had suffered. And he said on that occasion, 2008, physicians have long been members of a special moral community. Now, that is the idea of medicine and certainly the self-image of medicine that needs to be challenged when one looks at the history of medical racism in the United States. What I found after 15 years of research that went into the book is that, in fact, physicians' heads contain the same racial folklore, the same stereotypes, resentments, etc., as those of the general population. Every Western society is permeated by racial/racist folklore that is basically of 19th century origin. And it is surprising, but a fact, that there is a lot of residual 19th century racial anthropology that continues to be a part of racial life in the United States and elsewhere, and that inevitably seeps into the medical profession. What I found was that when you look at the last 50-100 years of medical literature, what you find is that racist folklore about black people has infiltrated virtually all of the significant medical specialties, and this becomes reflexive thinking. It is also confirmed by prominent people in the medical profession that open racism on the wards, you know, racist comments as offered casually, you know, without reservation by a certain number of doctors, is just part of the reality that African-American patients and physicians have to deal with. And if you want a spectacular confirmation of what we would assume would not be possible in an American medical environment, I'll read the lawsuit that Dr. Head and his attorney have filed against UCLA, which, based on the public record, has offered literally no specific denials of what is alleged regarding the comprehensive humiliation and harassment that he has suffered over the past several years.
We're speaking with John Hoberman, author of Black and Blue, The Origins and Consequences of Medical Racism, and a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Now, John, well, give some specifics for people, because I read that complaint, and it's stunning what's happened. What gives people some specifics so they understand what are you talking about here?
What we're talking about, again, the spectacular demonstration of, you know, what you euphemistically call racial insensitivity. In fact, it's persecution. I mean, just looking at page 8 of the lawsuit, there was an event in 2006, the end of year residence sort of social. 200 people, including spouses, non-physicians, are in attendance. There is a slideshow. And quoting from the lawsuit, one slide was particularly disturbing and racist. It was a picture of a hairy black gorilla with plaintiff's face superimposed on the gorilla as he was being sodomized by defendant Burke, who's the head of the head and neck surgery department in which Dr. Head was working, the so-called gorilla slide. There's a part of me that cannot believe that this actually happened in a respectable, even elite American medical school. It has to make us pose the question, if there is no safety for African American medical personnel in this environment, where can they find it? And part of studying medical racism in the United States over the past century or so is following the trials and the tribulations of black doctors, along with the tremendous difficulties and suffering of black patients who were often ignored, segregated, underserved. And the big mistake is to assume that medical racism belongs to the American past. If you say medical racism to the ordinary informed person, that person is likely to say, of course, Tuskegee, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment that began in 1932 and was ended in 1972 when not a doctor but a journalist blew the whistle on it. That was 40 years ago. We're past that stuff. That is the great illusion. And every approach to American medical racism that consigns it to the historical category is misleading and damaging in a way, because it is going to divert attention from what goes on every day behind closed doors in clinics in the America we know today. One of the most interesting and disturbing experiences that I've had in talking to African Americans about their medical situation is that talk to people, and we're talking here of educated, sophisticated people of means. And as soon as you scratch the surface, as soon as you bring up that person's or that person's family's experience with the medical profession, it is always the same in my experience. There is a lot of discomfort. There is our stories of the difficulties of finding any sort of, you know, compatible, emotionally comfortable relationships with physicians. It's hard enough to find good relationships with the physicians we need, even if we do not bear the burden of race in America. The news, the bad news, and most whites, of course, are not going to be aware of this, is that there is a whole universe of difficulty and suffering and differential diagnoses and treatments of black patients that remain essentially invisible in American society today. And the worst part, in a way, is that the medical profession in general, we're talking about the AMA, which was very late to desegregate in the late 60s. We're talking about the medical schools that offer so-called cultural competency courses that are really band-aids that are they are not competent to deal with the racial realities of race relations in the medical world today. There is no organized effort to do anything about this. In fact, medical education in this country is essentially race aversive. The nitty-gritty of African-American medical experiences is 99% absent from the curricula, and this is by design because it's uncomfortable. And the medical journals are a part of this in that the medical editors who enforce their standards and choose the material that makes it into the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, just to mention the two most prominent journals. These are very effective sort of gatekeeping arrangements that filter out the uncomfortable realities of race relations in medicine and actually shield doctors from knowing what their black patients really think of them. This is almost a taboo topic in the medical literature. There's a wonderful example from 2004 in the American Archive of Kidney Disease or something like that, that was carried out by a well-known physician on the staff of Harvard Medical School. And one of the things that he discovered was that the more self-confident, this was kidney transplant medicine, the more self-confident the white doctor was that he understood the wishes of the black patient, the less, in fact, he actually knew. In other words, what this white Harvard physician did was to interview the white nephrologists, then interview the black patients, and discover, lo and behold, a fundamental discrepancy between the self-understanding of the white physician on the one hand and what the black patient really thought and felt on the other. And it seems like an elementary requirement of medical research and medical education to do this sort of probing into cross-racial medical relationships, which are well known to be difficult. But in fact, the profession is not going to do inventories of the racist folklore that infiltrates medical specialties. It is going to leave white physicians with their privacy, as it were. They are not going to offer them meaningful training about how to better serve black patients, or at least some black patients.
Okay, John, let me ask you this, because I think that's important what you're saying, and it leads me to another question. And actually, my guest is John Hoberman from the University of Texas, Austin, and the author of Black and Blue, The Origins and Consequences of Medical Racism. John, you know, there's something that strikes me in everything you're saying, and what I read in your book was just stunning, you know, both the stuff from 100 years ago and how similar it is in content and form to what goes on today in the medical world in relation to black people as a whole. And it seems that there's a connection here between the overall ideological and political dehumanization of black people in America today and what happens in the medical field. I mean, there's the stunning thing of the continued assertion of things that literally come down to black people somehow are physiologically, anatomically, scientifically different than white people. And whether it's, you know, in some form or another, it actually ends up contributing to a dehumanization. And in some cases, including one that I think is really stunning and I'd like to talk a little bit about, is the idea of crack babies, which also you point out contributed to the whole effort to criminalize black youth in society today.
Yeah, what happened in the case of crack babies was that there was this tremendous rush to judgment during the 1980s that the African American infant in the womb was in effect being ruined, and that this person had no future really worth living, and these kids would be born sometimes addicted to the drugs, et cetera, et cetera. What was discovered and published in a mainstream medical journal, I think it was the Journal of the American Medical Association, as early as 1992, was this turned out to have been a kind of episode of medical hysteria. And what had happened was that the dominant, and the 80s, of course, are a period during which hard drugs are ravaging some of the African-American communities. This is well known, and this will contribute to the stereotyping of black people. What happens is that by the early 1990s, research is showing that this was, in effect, an illusion. But it's the kind of illusion that the historian of race could have predicted in a way on the basis of what we know about, say, 19th century slavery era, colonial era, ideas about what black people are like, out of control, violent. There were conservatives who jumped up, political conservatives who jumped on this and would say that these crack babies are born without souls. I mean, there was literally religious idiom from the conservative side was being imported into what was a kind of a medical situation. So in that sense, you can look back on the crack baby illusion or hysteria, whatever you want to call it, and say, you know, this was the end of the 20th century. It was not the end of the 19th century, where this sort of thinking would be more expected. It is sobering to encounter at the end of the 19th century this sort of what is in effect racist hysteria. It is sobering to encounter in the early 21st century a case like that of Dr. Head, where the use of the gorilla image, I mean, this is straight out of 19th century racist anthropology, ideas about retarded evolution, et cetera, et cetera. I think the bottom line here is that the racial folklore that formulated itself in the second half of the 19th century is very much alive inside our heads in certain ways. These are very powerful ideas, and we don't have an educational establishment, let alone a medical education establishment, that is really determined to do something about purging us of this harmful material.
You know, John, it's really interesting. We have about a minute and a half, but it's really interesting that in a world that's supposed to be so scientifically based in terms of medicine, that you would be able to have something flourish like this. It's so patently obvious that it's like totally non-scientific. It's amazing to me. And it's amazing and not amazing, because medicine, again, it's testimony to nothing escapes the overall embrace of the system that you're living in and what it puts forward.
Yeah, I think that's precisely the point. There are wonderful physicians, there are saint-like physicians, there are bad physicians selling drugs on the web and being negligent, etc. And then there is a huge number of people in between. And the bad news, if you want to put it that way, is that they are not, I mean, they ought to be members of a special moral community, to quote the late head of the AMA. But it turns out that it's a lot more complicated than that, and that the physicians among us are vulnerable to the kind of racial/racist material that floats around everywhere. Let us not forget that presidential candidate Ron Paul has spent his life as a physician. This is the same physician who put his name on, wrote, endorsed, whatever, openly racist material in his newsletter for two decades.
John, we have to wrap it up now. But point well taken, and I would say too that it's just, you know, again, it's just testament to this is we have a very, very long way to go to get rid of this kind of stuff. And the problem with all this stuff that we're talking about is that this has very real impact and serious consequences in the world. John, thank you very much for what you're doing, for your book, and for being on the show today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Sure, and I think I'll have you back to talk about this whole way that this plays out in sports, too, sometime in the near future, all right?
No problem.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with John Hoberman from the University of Texas, Austin, the author of Black and Blue, The Origins and Consequences of Medical Racism. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. He's Larry Everest. He's a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and he's a frequent guest on this show. And I want to read you something that he wrote before we get into it with Larry. 16 months after the Egyptian people rose up and drove the hated U.S. puppet Hosni Mubarak from power, the country has elected a new president. On Sunday, June 24th, a week after the June 16th, 17th runoff voting, Egypt's Constitutional Committee named Mohamed Morsi of the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood the winner over former General Ahmed Shafik. Shafik was the candidate backed by Egypt's military, which has run the country for the last 52 years. The U.S. government and media called the vote Egypt's first free and fair election. The Brotherhood, Egypt's military, and the U.S., which had been closely involved in these events, all praised the outcome as a victory for democracy. The transition from military rule to civilian control and a big step toward fulfilling the aspirations of Egypt's 90 million people and completing their revolution. Larry, what the hell's going on here? What's the truth, man?
Well, the truth is that it did nothing of the kind. There was no revolution. Mubarak was forced to step down by a very powerful and heroic uprising by the Egyptian people in January and February of 2011, about 18 or so months ago. But before Mubarak left, he simply handed power to the military, which was the foundation and the key pillar of the Egyptian state. And the core of this reactionary, repressive Egyptian state was never changed, was never dismantled. The courts, the police, and in particular the military. And this was a state that represented the interests of Egyptian capital, particularly Egyptian capital and its close relationship to and subordination to U.S. imperialism, both the U.S.-dominated global capitalist market, but more particularly the U.S. strategic objectives in the Middle East. I mean, Mubarak's Egypt and the Egyptian military has been a key client and a key military force for the United States in the region for the last several decades, in particular as a bulwark protecting Israel and helping Israel strangle the people of Palestine. So that state structure has remained in place, and the elections, as we'll get into, did nothing to change that.
Well, tell me that. What do you mean they did nothing to change that? I mean, that's kind of, that goes right up against everything that, you know, people will say, look, you know, the military was in there. Mubarak was in there. He's gone. The military was running things. They've had to actually step back a little bit. It actually was an expression of people, even whether it meant anything or not. People did go to the polls and vote.
Well, they did. But what were they voting for? The entire process had been shaped by the military, including the disqualification of various candidates and setting terms for who could and couldn't run. And the entire Egyptian state and superstructure of the media and so on was still very much in place. Now, the generals understood. Now, this isn't to say that there wasn't an awakening among the Egyptian people very, very broadly, but this election itself was a means of channeling that awakening, channeling that energy, channeling those very just desires for liberation into a solution that would simply maintain the status quo, in fact, re-legitimize the status quo. The Egyptian military and their U.S. backers understood they couldn't simply go back to a situation as had been the case of Mubarak. The Mubarak regime, in essence, needed a facelift, hence this election. But who really controlled power was very strikingly illustrated in the weeks leading up to the election of June 16th and 17th, which was the runoff election for president. This is something people really need to learn from because it doesn't often come out this starkly. Between June 13th and June 16th, right the days before the election, the Egyptian military, the Egyptian Interior Ministry, and the Egyptian court, all holdovers from Mubarak, number one,
gave sweeping powers to the military to arrest people. Number two, dissolved the parliament for which some 30 million people had voted for this parliament, which was dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood. It was disbanded by the Supreme Court of Egypt. And then the votes weren't even counted, and the Egyptian military issued decrees giving itself the right to rule in the absence of a parliament and the right to control the writing of a new constitution. So it was a very dramatic example about of what state power really is. State power isn't put up for a vote. State power determines and shapes how any votes take place. So it was a very striking example of this.
Yeah, I was going to say that, man. It actually does show you a whole hell of a lot about what state power rests on, as well as what the nature of state power is. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's a frequent guest on the show, and we're talking about the recent elections in Egypt and what it shows about the nature of the state in Egypt and about its relationship with U.S. imperialism and who's really running things when it comes to that part of the world right now. Now, Larry, tell me this. You know, one of the things that you started to talk about there, which I found is really fascinating, this whole question of the relationship between the military and what it's about and its ties to the U.S. and the Muslim Brotherhood and what it's about and its relationship with the U.S. and the competition and competing between those two and also the differences. Can we talk about that very complex relationship?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood has existed for 84 years, and for much of that time, it's been illegal. At the same time, we have, and this is an Islamist group, the foundation of its political and ideological program is the imposition of Islamic or Sharia law as the guiding ideology and legal basis for society. And this is an extremely reactionary position. This is akin to what is done in Saudi Arabia or in Iran, the Taliban in Afghanistan. I'm not saying these forces are identical, but we can see what sort of a horror religious Islamic fundamentalism, or any religious fundamentalism for that matter, would be. But at the same time the Brotherhood has been illegal, there are many ways that the Egyptian state has encouraged its growth as a counterweight to the nationalist and to the revolutionary left during the 70s and 80s. At this point, the Brotherhood's program is firmly to promote capitalism and to do nothing to challenge Egypt's place or to restructure Egypt's place within the global capital imperialist order. It's a group that represents the interests of Egyptian capitalists, in particular those who may have been somewhat pushed out of the action, if you will, by the military's very extreme and highly centralized control of key levers of the economy, as well as those who feel that Islamic ideology is a very necessary and important cohering ideology to maintain order in society, in particular oppressive order and a very highly stratified and class-divided order, and to maintain the sort of traditional relations that see women shoved down and subordinated in a very harsh patriarchy that we see across the Middle East. So the Brotherhood isn't at all challenging the fundamentals of the Egyptian order, although its program is to fight for Islam and religious fundamentalism to play a greater and greater role. And so really what we had with this election was a contest between two reactionary, outmoded social forces. And we can see through this election how they reinforce each other and actually work together with each other, even as they're contending over the exact shape of power within post-Mubarak Egypt. Now, one thing I think that's very important to note is that when Morsi was declared the winner and gave his acceptance speech, the first people that he praised were the military, the police, and the court. Therefore, and by the way, his ascension to the presidency happened there was a week after the vote before the military, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and the Mubarak Selection Commission announced that Morsi was, in fact, the winner. And during that week, there was reportedly a lot of backroom negotiations between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood over precisely the shape of the new government. But Morsi's statement made very clear that he was not going to prosecute the people that had murdered 800 Egyptians during and after the revolution. He wasn't going to prosecute the police that have brutalized the Egyptian people for so many years. And most importantly, he was not going to change Egypt's relationship with Israel, and in particular the 1979 Camp David Accords that made Egypt a backer of Israel and had very important military implications for Israel and the United States in the region.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the recent elections in Egypt and what it shows about the nature of the state in Egypt and about its relationship with U.S. imperialism. And, you know, Larry, one thing I'd ask you, too, though, in relation to that, and this is something that had me curious, is because I think it's really important what you're saying about all this, but there also seems to be some complexity here that we need to dig into a little bit more. You know, the idea that when you talked about the two outmoded and that the two outmoded, the trends in that are in the world today, you have it, between imperialism and Islamic fundamentalism and the people serving imperialism, the people serving Islamic fundamentalism, you have all of this, and yet it's happening within the same country, and both of them are pretty much, I mean, the U.S. is not saying, look, we're not going to allow the Brotherhood to get into power, nor are they saying we're giving up the army, to hell with it, don't worry about it, you know. But there is, it's this complexity. Normally when this struggle between these two reactionary outmoded's occurs, it's usually in a different kind of circumstance, huh?
Well, it's true, and I think the key element of this, which makes the Brotherhood different than, say, the Khomeini revolution in Iran or Hamas, is that the Brotherhood, number one, is not in direct clash with U.S. or Israeli interests. And number two, it's made clear that it's willing to abide by the essentials of the current status quo. And I think that the United States, I mean, one of the reasons that this election commission reportedly named Morsi the winner was that the U.S. was very concerned that the millions of people had their expectations raised, millions were in political motion, and it would have undermined the Egyptian state and actually undermined U.S. power if there had been a direct head-on confrontation between the military and the Brotherhood. This is why you had people like Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta telling the generals, look, go along with this vote. I mean, it was clear that Morsi had won this vote. Go along with this vote, because the U.S. realizes that it's important to broaden the basis of legitimacy of this pro-imperialist state. Remember, nothing is being done that fundamentally that undermines or takes down the fundamental pillars of this state. So in this situation, the U.S. felt this was the way to go. It is complicated because even within, on this new stage, with Morsi as the president, with the pro-Mubarak judiciary and military still in place, there is a complex battle going on for who has what kind of influence and how to legitimize the whole thing. For example, on Sunday, Morsi called the parliament back into session. The next day, the Supreme Court said, no, 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 you can't do that. Our earlier ruling disbanding the parliament stands. Yet parliament did meet briefly, and the military didn't try to stop it from meeting. But then what did parliament do? They referred this to another court of appeals. So there is a complex struggle going on, and it's also possible that the Brotherhood's ascension can further fuel Islamist trends around the region, which will not be so easy to control. I read one thing from the Wall Street Journal that raised grave concerns about the regime, the monarchy in Jordan falling. And of course, this is a key CIA outpost, essentially, and U.S. client regime that's very strategically important for the U.S. and Israel. So there is a potential that things can spin out of control and that things can go in directions that create new problems. But the most important point is there hasn't been any kind of a revolution, and neither Morsi nor the military represent any sort of revolutionary solution or fulfillment of the aspirations of the people of Egypt for liberation.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the current situation in Egypt. Now, Larry, I was really glad you got into that in the way you did, because I was going to say there is also the aspect of all this that it's not like the U.S. has just a free rein there, that it's all freedom and they're not up against some pretty heavy necessity in that part of the world, including all the things that you've been talking about. But it raises a bigger question. Since you did speak to all that, it also raises a bigger question, which is, what the hell is the solution as far as you see?
Well, I think that, as I said, what we've seen is that as long as the state power continues to exist without a genuine, real revolution, there can't be any fundamental change. And my article this week is posted at revcom.us, and the newspaper also posted a very insightful statement from Bob Avakian, which he wrote actually in February 2011, the very day that Mubarak was forced to step down. And he makes the point that history has shown that there have been various examples of a strong man, a tyrant driven from power, in the Philippines, in Iran, now in Egypt, in which simply another tyrant or the same kind of structure has been left in place. And that's what's critical is to look at the experience of Russia in 1917 and the leadership of Lenin, because they were in a very similar position. In February 1917, the U.S. and the French, and the particularly the French and the British, did manage to force the Tsar, sort of comparable to Mubarak, to leave power. And they were trying to put in place another regime that would basically do the same thing, but that would seem more democratic and so on. But because of the leadership of Lenin and the Bolshevik Party, the communists at that point, they had an understanding that this wasn't going to bring liberation to the people. They understood that you needed a revolution to abolish the despotic system and to build a whole new socialist and communist society and state. And Lenin succeeded in that. It was just a global earthquake and ushered in a whole new era of human history. And Avakian, in his statement, which I really highly recommend people to read, Avakian makes the point that when masses of people rise up, it is essential, the decisive element as to whether people gain liberation, really take strides toward emancipation, or are simply led into a dead end. The key element of that is whether or not there's a leadership, a communist leadership, with the necessary scientific understanding and method, and on that basis can develop a strategy and means of building ties with people, and really leading a revolution that dismantles these oppressive structures and creates a whole different kind of state. He refers to the publication Communism, the Beginning of a New Stage, a manifesto from the Revolutionary Communist Party, which sums up this history of revolutions over the past 150 years and elaborates a re-envisioned socialism and communism that Avakian has brought forward. It's sort of a very succinct guideline for fighting for real liberation.
All right. And on that note, we will have to wrap it up, man.
That's a good note to wrap it up
on. There you go. All right, Larry. Thanks a lot, man. You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've been talking with Larry Everest, journalist and writer with Revolution Newspaper. And we've been talking about the recent developments in Egypt and what it means for the people in Egypt and people all over the world. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back. So stay tuned. In late May, I joined the Basics bus tour as it rolled into Sanford, Florida, the town where Trayvon Martin was killed. The tour brought the work and vision of Bob Avakian and his book Basics into Sanford, and I spent my time in the black neighborhood of Goldsboro talking with the people about their lives and digging into the deep questions of how to change things. Now, people were receptive to what we had to say, but at the same time, it took work and struggle. We wrestled over how to really change things, who could you rely on, could you depend on voting, and all kinds of questions. And all this was part of bringing forward a movement for revolution in Sanford as part of a growing movement for revolution across the country. This is part three of my series, Getting Down to Basics with the People of Sanford. Goldsboro, one of the major black neighborhoods in Sanford, Florida, wasn't always a downpressed neighborhood. In 1891, Goldsboro was a black city, founded by laborers and only the second black city incorporated in Florida. It was the third in the country overall. Goldsboro was a center of black life with a vibrant economy and all the services that every other city had. All that ended in 1911 when the city of Sanford decided it needed to expand west. Powerful white figures in Florida teamed up with Sanford city officials and dissolved the city charter of Goldsboro, turning this thriving city into a black ghetto in Sanford. Resources were taken away from the city. Even the street names were changed to whitewash the new neighborhood. In the years that followed, Ku Klux Klan terror enforced the change and all that came with it. In the 1960s, the city of Sanford built a new civic center with all kinds of recreation facilities. Only white citizens of Sanford were allowed to enjoy the new center. Black people had a tiny, beat-up recreation room in one of the housing projects that they called the center, and they were allowed to use that for dances and other gatherings. When black youth decided they would integrate the new civic center and attend a whites-only dance, white adults turned a fire hose on them to drive them away. Later in the 1960s, the public swimming pool in Sanford closed down because one black youth dared to jump into the whites-only pool on a hot summer day. When the people of Goldsboro demanded a public pool be opened in their neighborhood, the city officials obliged but very quickly closed it down, claiming that it costs too much to maintain. As I learned more about the history of Goldsboro and got to know the present up close, I was reminded of a conversation I had a few years ago with a 90-year-old woman who had been forced out of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. As I sat talking with her and her family about what had happened to them, the old woman was very quiet. Then, just before she opened up with her story, she told me that sometimes it was real hard to talk about what happens to black people in the South, because she still felt that she was living just next door to slavery and all the horror that meant. I ran into a hell of a lot of people in Sanford who knew that feeling well. Leon was one of them. I met Leon at the Speak Out in front of the Sanford police station. Leon's life has been torn apart by the way things are in Sanford, and he felt a very close connection to Trayvon Martin and his family.
When I heard about it, it took me back to my own son, because that's almost the same thing happened to my son. It's like they couldn't find no witnesses. They couldn't do anything about it because they don't find the right shooter. But if these guys shooting at each other, they was black-on-black crime shooting at each other. My son was in his bicycle trying to run out the way. He got struck in the back by the bullet. And then they got all the guys that shot guns, they turned the guns in. Those guys walked free. They said, well, ain't nothing we can do because we need the right gun. That's what I'm thinking about Trayvon. That could have been my son, too, because look what happened to my son. They did nothing about it. And somebody got to do something, you know what I'm saying? This need to stop. You know what I'm saying? It's not right. And after my son died, I'm still thinking about my son every day. He been gone now, going on 6 years. And nobody got prosecuted for it. Nobody. They holler, oh, they'll be back. Don't worry about me. They'll be back to court. Some of them have went back to court, and some of them isn't went to prison, but it wasn't right at the time. And I don't appreciate that. And then we got to sit right here and be quiet. We said too much. They want to harass us and stop us and wonder what we're doing here. And they always talking to the black folks' neighborhood, coming down here and sitting around, but you don't see them sitting nowhere else. And I'm not trying to make it a black and white thing, but they don't sit in the other neighborhood that's real quiet. They always around us.
Leon was so angry his lips were quivering. Then he turned his head and waved to his wife. He told me they were having a tough time right now. Their other son had just been railroaded into prison on serious drug charges. Charges that Leon knows are trumped up.
And then not in a target my son now. Holland, he done, they got him a conspiracy talking about he attempted to sell. And my son wasn't even home. It happened a year ago. I went to work, come home, I cooked some collard greens, take on the job, went to work, come home, my dough kicked in. So I asked my friend, do you have your gun on? He said, yes, I do. He said, what's the matter? I said, somebody gonna kick my door. And he said, don't go in the house. He said, someone can still be in the house. I said, okay. I said, what I gotta do? He said, call the police department. I called the police department. They came 5 to 6 deep. When they came, one lady came with a long ponytail. She drive the motorcycle. I never forget her, but she was nice. She said, sir, we don't wait no bike up because we don't know who in the house. They goes in the house, wasn't in my house good 2 minutes. Come out the door, you can't come in your house. What you mean I can't come in my house? We found drugs and dope money, everything thrown through the whole house. Well, let me see it. No, sir, you can't see anything. Have a seat. I appreciate you cooperate this here the right way. And it wasn't a minute later, here come two policemen coming around the corner with hoods on their head, going in my house with a suitcase. Ain't let me see nothing. Made me sit outdoors all that time, like 4 or 5 hours. Ain't let me see a thing. And then gonna tell me, well, this is what we gotta do. You need who in that bike? Who you stay in that bike room? I said, that was my son. We needs to get in him. I said, well, I don't know where they're at. I don't have his number. You sure you don't have his number? No, I don't. So I had to wait till my wife get home close to 4 o'clock to get Irville to the house. So finally I said, Irville, you better come to the house. The police waiting on you. I'm not coming there, Dad. I ain't been to your house. Next thing you know, police said, well, Irville don't get him, somebody going to jail. That's the only reason my son came home. Talking about he need to sign the consent form for him to search the room. You and I been in there 3 hours searching the whole house. And then gonna come out hollering and lock my son up over something. Ain't take no fingerprints on the bags to see what it's on. They ain't test the powder to see what's the drugs or anything. You know what I'm saying? So my son went to jail. We bond him out with his friends and everybody else around. Cause he hang with a number of white guys. You know what I'm saying? He's a black guy, but he hang with all white guys. They got the money together and bond my son out of jail. Now he finally went to court. The police gonna sit there and lie and say and tell us that somebody going to jail. They lied on us yesterday, and it wasn't right. I said, well, I slept in that room the night before, but you gonna say I'm lying? You gonna say my wife lying? And then y'all gonna lock my son up talking about no bond status? Gonna sentence him for something y'all speculate ain't nothing been done about it? I can see if you caught him red-handed with drugs. I ain't saying my son innocent, because I know my son had did things in the past. But I know for a fact my son was not staying in my household, but they gonna tell me I'm lying. I don't appreciate that. Mister, you lying for your son. You love your son, don't you? I love my son when he doing right. Don't sit me up here where I feel like y'all lying. They keep sending me out the courthouse, then bring my wife in, then bring my daughter-in-law in, because my daughter-in-law white. They brings her in and question, well, you cheating the government. The police department ain't right. Those undercover policemen was at my house, I know what they looked like, and they was not right. And we going to go until we get to the end of this, because I don't appreciate what they done to me yesterday. It was wrong. They had a whole jury up there, half of them saying he was guilty, half of them saying he was not guilty. But Judge Lester, the same one, got Zimmerman, said no bond status, lock him up to a court date. That wasn't right. He could have gave my son a bond. He could have gave him a bond to get himself out to see what's going on, to get himself situated and move the stuff around. He need to move out his car, whatever, and get everything. He said no bond status, and it wasn't right. And we done got a, lawyer and everything for my son. They said, it's a sandwich. The prosecutors locked my son up, and then now the lady that helped my son, I couldn't do nothing. So, well, ain't nothing I can do. I did all I can do. And it's not right. And they're talking to, not, I ain't saying black, but a lot of black people's getting targeted like this and getting things on their license saying you can't vote or do anything when you got that done. Nothing. You know what I'm saying? You's a criminal now. So you can't get nothing done. And it wasn't right the way they did my son. It wasn't right. And I don't appreciate it. And I'm going to keep doing something until I get something done. And I ain't going to stop just now because it wasn't right.
We started talking about the way this system dehumanizes and grinds up black people, especially the youth. I read him Basics 111 about how this system puts the vast majority of black youth through a meat grinder and then holds up the few that make it through as an example of how the system works. Leon thought a lot about the system dehumanizing black youth, and I asked him if he saw any connection between what had happened to his sons and what happened to Trayvon.
Yes, I do. It was a lot of connection. They did not do the investigation right. And like I told them about my son, they didn't do the investigation right on that. And the same thing happened to Trayvon can happen to any of our kids. Not just because of his color, it can happen to any of our kids. It wasn't right. And Sanford been doing this for a long time. A lot of people done got swept under the rug around here. A lot of them just sit around here and live in this town and don't say nothing. But it's time to speak up now. But if something happened, they don't prosecute everybody like they supposed to. And you know what I'm saying? Like this man got hit downtown, and cause that was the chief buddy. I don't know how it went on. I think I got it right by seeing it on TV. This black man got hit downtown from a white guy in the head. And then the chief, they didn't even lock that man up for doing that because he belonged to somebody in the police department. And I'm speaking the truth. It's in the document. I'm speaking the truth. They didn't do anything about it. The only reason something got done about it because somebody let the video go downtown, and that's how it got on TV, and Channel 9 put it out there. And then they want to do something about it. And that's why I said this ain't the first time it happened with Trayvon. It happened to a lot of our black kids. Whether they wrong or right, these are our kids. We need to help them do right. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not angry about the situation. It's not just right.
I read Leon Basics 113, and we talked about it.
No more generations of our youth, here and all around the world, whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system is destined for oppression and oblivion, even before they are born. I say no more of that.
I believe that.
What do you think of it, though?
I believe that. Yeah. I believe it's true. I really believe all this, what he's saying, is true.
Well, you think about this, no more generations of our youth, not just here and there, but generations.
Exactly. That's what they're trying to do, get rid of all the generations that's coming up now. You know what I'm saying? They don't want them to have nothing in life. They don't want them to go nowhere in life. And they mocking for the, oh, you ain't going to never be nothing. You know what I'm saying? You ain't going to do this, you ain't going to do that. And I see it all the time. I'm 52 years old, and I've been going through a lot. I've seen the struggles and things going through life. I brought my kids up. Them are the two boys I got. I got other kids down in Titusville and Mims. You know what I'm saying? And I be wishing the best for them, too. But it's time for a change. And that's why I tell everybody we need to start trying to vote and get the right people in the courthouse where they need to be at. Because it's not fair the way they're doing our youth around here. It's not right. And I'm not saying my son innocent. Yes, he have did bad things in life. But he didn't deserve what he got yesterday. That wasn't right. Trayvon didn't deserve what he got. That wasn't right. And what they do, they let Zemlin go home and told my son no bond status. But they let Zemlin go home over murder. My son ain't killed nobody. They got him off of speculation. Well, we think this is his stuff. They got him over speculation saying that he wasn't even staying in my house. Wasn't even at my house at all. He was gone for 6 months. But then they holler, he been at the house, and it wasn't right. I'm trying to do right in court, make sure I say the right thing. They going to call me a liar. They called my wife a liar yesterday. I'm here telling the truth. You know, it's not right.
Leon and I wrestled around the source of the problem and the solution, specifically around how to really change things. We talked about things like stop and frisk in New York and the mass incarceration of black youth and how all this adds up to a slow genocide that could turn into a quick one if people don't stand up and resist now. When I went back to how the capitalist system is behind all this, Leon started to work out his thoughts by going back to what happens to his son all the time.
They do it with my son all the time because he hang with white people at night. He gets stopped. Every time he with somebody in the white, they stop him, figuring they up no good, that got dope in the car. Mr. Fitzgerald, you got dope in your car? This is the way they treat my son all the time. They don't stop my son, I guarantee you, if he's on the police report, they don't stop him at least about 10, 11 times around here for no reason. We got a prescription that this car is, Mr. Fitzgerald, you got any drugs in the car? So I don't do drugs. Ain't nothing, you can search my car. Ain't nothing in my car but my gun in the glove compartment, and it's my gun. They checks it out, okay, Mr. Fitzgerald, you can go, we just have to do this. Why stop him every time you see him? He done went and got his car painted, figure, well, I get my car painted at him, maybe they'll leave me alone. You know what I'm saying? So he wrecks with me. He wrecks with me all the time. They don't even know he wrecks with me. I do DJ wreck. I cook. My son helped me. I said, son, if you feel like you got to go out there and do drugs, you don't need to do this. Help with me, and I will help you. But don't be accusing him of something that he didn't do and he was not staying in my house. You know what I'm saying? Don't accuse Trayvon when he got that hood on his head. He gonna get dead, and he running down the road. Well, I got a suspicious person down the road. They told him on the thing, sir, don't chase him. Don't do that, sir. And next thing you know, the man dead. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't right. I seen all the marksmen come in Sanford. They want to make like we trying to be the violence one, but it's not. We trying to hold peace. And then next thing I know, I think about my son the same way my son got killed. They did nothing about it. Sanford Police Department did nothing. Seminole County did nothing. It went under the rug. And my son was only 23 years old and got shot by his own kind. And they did nothing about the one that shot him. And it wasn't right. I want this to get out. We need to know. Just like Trayvon, we need this stuff to stop. It's time for all of it to stop. It's time.
I listened to Leon and then asked what he thought when I said that revolution, communist revolution, is the solution and that this is what Bob Avakian's work and vision is all about.
We do need it. It's time. This should have been out. I'm sorry it had to happen through that lady's son. I know how she feel. This should have been going on. You know what I'm saying? By Trayvon getting shot, everything started coming out. The whole world doing it now, and it is good. But the whole world need to know all the things going on around here, not just Trayvon, everything.
Did you ever think, though, in your life, did you ever think that you'd be sitting here and you would have met a movement for revolution?
No, sir, I didn't. I never thought I'd never see this day coming, and I'm 52 years old. I never thought I'd seen it coming. You know what I'm saying? It's time for a change. This should have been going on. You know, I'm sorry I had to happen to that lady's son because I know how she feels. I lost mine, and I know exactly how she feels. God knows I do.
All right, well, that wraps up our show for today. I want to thank all of my guests. I want to thank my board op, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Keb Mo's cover of Someday We'll All Be Free.